trust there are times you can feel that way too. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, October 15th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, Dan Raphael, and Anna Wilcox. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodewell. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonio Gonzalez, Farah Siddiqui, Eric Galatas, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 Hood River on 91.9 FM.
That's K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KABU programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KABU to 44321. Stay tuned now for KABU's News in Depth.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Jenny Moore, correspondent with Street Roots, to talk about her latest story. It's called Look to Le Guin. New exhibit exposes Portlanders to the magical worlds of legendary author Ursula K. Le Guin. In dozens of books, she explored humanity's darkness and potential for redemption. Welcome to the show, Jenny.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. So let's get into your article. It talks about an exhibit coming up later this month at Oregon Contemporary called A Larger Reality. What will be in this exhibit?
It's curated by her son, and many other people who knew the author or knew her work well contributed to it. There's a bunch of special events with it, but it's got an accompanying book that has a series of her work in it. There's text, images, audio, video. There's a bunch of stuff. It also says it's going to have kind of like a range of ways to experience it, whether you want to have a discussion about it with somebody and, talk their head off, or if you want to just lean back and unwind. It's supposed to kind of offer a way to engage with her work, whether you're new to her work and learning about her or you're obsessed with everything she ever did.
Well, maybe let's speak to folks who are newer to Ursula K. Le Guin. You wrote a great piece about this. Can you give us a brief history? What's important to know about her?
I think that was honestly the hardest part about writing and researching this piece, is that she was such a beast and had such an amazing bibliography. She's mostly known for her early works, though, and for her contribution to the sci-fi and fantasy genre. She came out at a time when sci-fi and fantasy wasn't necessarily like a respected genre. And she is known for one of her first published works, A Wizard at Earthsea, which at the time was initially wrote for young readers, but the series became kind of a life of its own, and it really can be enjoyed by any age of reader. But honestly, her career is like so, so deep. Like, she's written, books of essays, she's written children's books, while she's, mostly known as a novelist. If you just want to read her poems or kid books like Cat Wings, or like, there's just so much there to find. But I think knowing kind of what drove her storytelling and like her evolution of an artist is really important. So she was really driven in terms of her ideas. She really was inspired by pacifist anarchism, Taoism, feminism. And I think when she first came out, she had very different ideas, but it's really cool to watch her development as a thinker change through her work. But yeah, she was a hardcore feminist, dude. And it's just really refreshing to read her stuff because she was so ahead of her time on so much, even on gender fluidity and the things she spoke about, writes about, and focused on in her work and her book talks and podcasts and all the stuff that she left behind is just wow, this is all so relevant forever.
Well, and she has a special connection to Portland as well.
Yes, one of the major things. She's one of the most Portlandist treasures ever.
You talked about this whole spectrum of her work, some of which are going to be on display in this exhibit, but I mean, you did all this research. Are there works of hers that in particular seem to have more resonance these days?
What I think is cool is that she had really so much that she left us to read. I personally didn't get into fantasy and sci-fi until I was probably 10 years ago, honestly, and I'm not even deep into that world, so I, haven't really read a ton of her novels because I'm just now wanting to start reading that genre. But I love her short stories and I really love her essays, which for me, as a new mom, I have 2 kids under 3. For me, it's all very resonant because of what she wrote about. She, her feminism changed at a certain point to now to become more maternal and seeing women's lives and experiences as art and as not secondary, but just as powerful and important. And when I look at her, her list of more than 20 books and all this other stuff she wrote, it's she had 3 children in 7 years. And then she wrote her first novels and had this enormous career. And I'm I just love that she advocates for women to not have to choose between being a mom and being an artist or being a writer, kind of older iterations of feminism did. It's more she's thinking about motherhood as a, talking about it as an advantage as an artist. And I don't know. I just think her kind of subverting a lot of these conventions and just the way she discusses a lot of different parts of, life. It's just, I could talk about this stuff forever, and this is a tiny segment, but I think a lot of her stuff around motherhood and feminism is really, really resonant for me and just so impressive how ahead of her time she was. It's a good thing the piece was 2,300 words, because I usually have to rein it in a lot more and be okay, how do I talk about this giant person's career in 800 words and sum it all up, here's what you need to know, you know what I mean? She's known for these amazing novels maybe primarily, but I think I won't even say some of her best stuff, but some of my favorite stuff that I've written from her are her A Left-Handed Commencement Address at Mills College in 1983, and the stuff she was talking about in there, about even how the education and academia is framed, discussed, the words we use are all words of power. You know, it's a man's language. And she talks about how even in the speech she's giving, she's supposed to, she's expected to, wish them all success, which kind of inherently means that you have power over other people, right? So just kind of her discussions about power and what success means. Does it mean other people are lower than you? Does it mean you have power over other people? And she kind of says success is somebody else's failure, and the American dream we keep dreaming is not necessarily one we should keep aspiring to if it means other people have to be impoverished for us individuals to be successful. And I thought it was just like kind of poignant the way she said, like, if I spoke like a woman instead of spoke like a man at this address, that would sound strange almost, because you would think it sounds weird or terrible if I said, first, I hope, like, if, instead of saying, I hope you have success, first, I hope that if and only if that you want kids, I hope you have them, not hordes of them, a couple. I hope you have enough kids. I hope they're beautiful. I hope, you know, they have enough to eat and a place to be warm and clean in and friends. And I hope you have work you like doing. And it's kind of like, I just think it's interesting with all that's going on in the world that we're not talking more about quote unquote feminine perspective. You know, everything, one thing I love that she always reiterated was like, are we as women, when we are successful or are given the role of the hero, are we just being honorary men, or are we honoring our point of views as women or whatever gender we are, or are we just kind of assimilating, you know, even in our thinking, in the way we talk, in the things we choose to talk about, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I could listen to her answer questions like these at book talks that are all over YouTube and just read her essays on stuff like this all the time, because I'm like, this is literally the moment. Like,
you mention in the piece that Le Guin's house is also possibly going to be preserved by the group Literary Arts. What's their plan?
Yeah, I keep trying to check up on that. What I could tell is that the fundraising campaign is well underway, and they've already raised some money for it. But yeah, the Le Guin family did donate their home last year to Literary Arts to create the Ursula K. Le Guin Writer's Residency, and I hope I get in. But yeah, the plan, from what I can tell, is to give people like a place to focus and have quiet, because one thing that she often talked about was how she, as a mom, would always have to write when her children were sleeping, and just how constraining a writing schedule can be if you have a family, especially moms who write. It can be really, really hard to find just a room with quiet and actually be able to focus.
What do you hope folks take away from this story?
I mean, I really just hope that people are inspired to learn more about her and read her words and check out her books and honestly dig into YouTube. Because one of the things, I mean, there's so much I hope people take away from it. One thing I thought was really interesting about her is how she wasn't really on social media at all. Like, she was not of that world, but she might. Now her son runs an Instagram for her. But I thought it was really cool how, even though she wasn't super digital in terms of social media, she still, like, did a lot of emailing and responded to her emails. And she also, like, was answering her phone well into her old age, like her own phone, and literally responding to her own emails and, like, doing these readings and answering just so many questions from, like, you know, all kinds of questions of people asking her about religion or creative process or whatever it was. And she just takes it all in, and she always gave such thoughtful answers that, I don't know, like, I literally could watch those on YouTube for, like, days, because they're so long. And it's just like, I don't know, she just feels like so present in the moment, you know what I mean? Like, the things she says too, I'm just like, oh gosh, I want to just, like, live like her. I just want to, like, it just seems like there's so much to learn and glean from her legacy and the way she lived so according to her principles. And, like, yeah, as a thinker, a woman, a mom, a writer, I just, yeah, so admire her.
Where can our listeners find out more? Where can they read this article for themselves?
Street Roots is in print all week. Can go on their website to find a vendor, and then I believe it'll be at the website, which is streetroots.org.
Awesome. Well, Jenny, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Street Roots correspondent Jenny Moore speaking with me about her latest story for the paper. It's called Look to Le Guin. New exhibit exposes Portlanders to the magical worlds of legendary author Ursula K. Le Guin. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Terrence Burns. Joining us in the studio today are Michelle Manning and Vera Lewis from the African American Alliance for Home Ownership. We'll be talking about their upcoming home ownership fair this evening. Michelle and Vera, thank you so much for joining us. First, would you like to introduce yourselves to our listeners?
Hi, thanks for having us. My name is Vera Lewis, and I am the executive assistant to Ms. Cheryl Roberts, and I'm also a HUD certified housing counselor.
Hi, my name is Michelle Manning, and I'm also a HUD certified housing counselor over at, we call it AAH, African American Alliance for Home Ownership.
The African American Alliance for Home Ownership was founded in Portland. What inspired its founding?
So some local businesses and government and nonprofit leaders saw that there was injustice in housing and equity injustice among African Americans in throughout our history and more particularly in Portland. And so they saw the need to do something about that, and that's how AAH was formed.
Yeah. And I'll just kind of add on to that originally we just started as hosting these community fairs, homeownership fairs, to get information out to the Black community in Portland, because information was one of the big things that was being restricted. People didn't even know what processes to follow to buy a home, and really didn't understand what their rights were as they were going through the homeownership process. So we started with these community fairs and have just grown exponentially since then.
Here's another thing that I thought was interesting about your work being so important, that Black Oregonians were historically displaced from the Albina neighborhood and also displaced by the Vanport floods. How does that fit in with your organization?
Yeah, Vera, do you want to take that? Or?
Well, we work with anyone, but African Americans and other underserved individuals are our primary focus. We like to see them in those neighborhoods where they've been displaced. And we try to focus on that. Again, though, it is up to the clients where they want to live, of course, but we do, you know, if they want to be in those displaced neighborhoods, then we try to work with them to make that happen.
Yeah, and something that we do a lot is partnering with government bodies. And so City of Portland has a program to provide financial assistance to help folks who have been displaced from North and Northeast Portland, specifically the Albina area, but kind of broadly North and Northeast. And so folks go through a process with the city and apply and kind of show documentation that their family has been displaced, and then they can receive some significant financial assistance to make up for the generational wealth that was essentially stripped from their families when they were displaced.
Mm. Another question, what successes are you most proud of at your organization? Either of you can answer.
Yeah, I can jump in. As I mentioned earlier, we started with the fairs, and it was really community driven, and that was a huge reason why AAH has continued to grow and succeed, because it really had the backing of the community. But we've grown a lot since then, and we do we have a whole spectrum of programs, not just the homeownership counseling and getting folks into their first homes, but now we have tons of programs for homeowners who may want to pursue solar energy for their homes or do other types of energy efficiency upgrades. We have a program for folks to set up a will and estate plan so that they can make sure that legally everything is in place for them to pass pass on this huge asset of home ownership. So we have a whole slew of things that we provide now that were, I think, just maybe not even on Cheryl Roberts' mind at the very beginning, but 25 plus years later, here we are.
There's a little question that relates to that. Is home ownership easier or harder now, or somewhere between?
That's a great question.
I would say that it's harder in the sense of there's a huge gap in affordability. Mm-hmm. And so we try to work to fill that gap with different funds that we receive. Mm-hmm. But I would say yes, in that sense.
Yeah, I would agree.
I wanted to ask, what successes are you most proud of at your organization?
Yeah. I mean, I think as a housing counselor, there are a lot of clients. I'm not going to name names for privacy purposes, but thinking about some of the families that we've worked with, so many of them come in the door really feeling like, is this even possible? Like, is it silly of me to even take this step? And once we start breaking down the process and working with them, I think, one, they start to realize how big of a process buying a home is, but then they start to realize, yes, they can do this. And a lot of them do need assistance, guidance, maybe financial assistance. But when we start putting those pieces together, there have been some families that I think we truly saved from being at risk of houselessness because they were renting and just in these really unstable situations. And now they're homeowners with a very affordable mortgage, and they're in a great spot for their families to thrive.
Do you guys teach people about the paperwork and all the things that they have to do in order to buy a house?
Oh, yes.
That's got to be the scariest part. And
yeah,
then
and I'd just like to add to, not only do we help them, you know, as Michelle was kind of touching on our programs, but it's not just about getting them into a home. And we also help them retain, maintain, and sustain the home through the programs that she just mentioned. So we really are, think of us as a one-stop shop of all things home ownership.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
What changes would you like to see in the future?
Ooh.
I'd like to see more funding.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I mean, I think we've grown a lot in recent years, like in terms of number of staff and things like that and our capacity. But still, I mean, on a daily basis, our mighty staff of like 10, we all wear multiple hats and are running multiple programs. So I think, yeah, if we could secure more funding that would allow us to, you know, serve more folks, that would be huge.
Your home ownership fair is coming up. What can people expect, and what kind of things can people learn at the fair?
Yeah. Vera, do you want to start? You want me to jump in on that?
I'll start. I would say that they can expect to potential homeowners and homeowners they will have access to lenders, realtors, and everything in between. There's workshops. There's even a kids' space.
Nice.
Good music.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, cool.
We have a great DJ.
Yeah.
And I think also it's not just for people looking to buy their first home, but current homeowners as well. We will have folks talking about, you know, if you want to do energy efficiency upgrades, mm-hmm. we'll have vendors that work with that, nonprofits and for-profits. We'll have the Portland Tool Libraries represented, which a lot of people don't know about, but they are a free resource where you can check out tools.
Oh.
So, you know, if you're buying a home and then you now have a yard to take care of, you may not have the funds immediately to go buy a lawnmower and a trimmer and all the things, but the tool library is a great resource. So we're going to have lots of things like that for both renters looking to buy their first home, but also homeowners.
Wow, that's great. It sounds really educational and something that seems like everyone should attend.
Yes.
Where will it be? Where is the fair?
It will be at the Doubletree, at Lloyd Center Doubletree, on Saturday, October 25th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Yes.
Free parking. Free parking.
Oh, free hooray. Parking. And the event is free as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's even better.
Yes. Yep.
Where can people find more information about the event?
Folks can just go to our website, which is www.aw, so that's 3 A's, then an H, .org. And there's a big banner at the top that says Homeownership Fair.
Well, I wanted to thank you both for coming in today, and that was a really good advertisement and plug for this event, which is really important, and as many people that could attend should. How could you lose by coming?
Right, and we're going to have raffles, ooh. So come for the raffles.
Hooray. Well, I guess I just want to thank you both for talking with us today. You've been listening to KABU News in Depth. The African American Alliance for Home Ownership Fair is coming up on October 25th at 1000 Northeast Multnomah Street. More information is online at ayaah.org. I'm Terrence Burns, and stay tuned. Did it.
Suppose they gave a coal auction and nobody came. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
For the first time ever, the amount of global electricity generated by renewable energy surpassed that from coal during the first 6 months of 2025.
According to the think tank Ember, solar and wind power increased more than the demand for electricity. Fossil fuel power generation remained mostly flat and fell in China and India, but grew in the US and the EU.
For 3 years, solar power has been the largest source of new electricity in the world, and most of that generation is in lower-income countries.
The growth has been sparked by dramatic cost reductions of solar, with prices falling about 99.9% since 1975.
The International Energy Agency reports that global renewable energy capacity is forecast to double in the next 5 years, with China accounting for 60% of that growth, mostly using solar.
Bucking the worldwide trend, the Trump administration canceled a massive solar power project in Nevada last week, which was permitted under the Biden administration. It would have been one of the world's largest, and the move cast doubt over the future of using public lands for renewables in the U.S.
Trump administration efforts to promote fossil fuels were met last week with little interest from the private sector. An auction of coal leases on federal lands in Montana attracted only one bid for 0.1 cents per ton, a tiny fraction of the most recent offer.
Auctions of coal leases on federal lands are going forward despite the government shutdown because workers responsible for fossil fuel projects were not furloughed by the administration.
A group of researchers from Rice University has found a way to capture and destroy PFAS compounds from water that's faster, more sustainable, and more effective than current methods.
PFAS substances, also called forever chemicals, have been used in nonstick cookware, clothing, and food packaging, among other products.
They're found everywhere on Earth, including nearly half of all tap water in the U.S. The compounds are harmful to human health, causing liver disease and affecting endocrine and reproductive systems.
While the new research is good news for purifying drinking water, concerns are being raised about PFAS from another source, data centers, such as those used by Amazon, Microsoft, Google, and AI providers.
Recent attention on data centers has focused on the amount of electricity they demand and the immense amount of water they use to cool equipment.
Some facilities are starting to use PFAS gas, sometimes called F-gas, which, according to The Guardian, could mean that their effects on climate change are worse than thought.
F-gas can be a potent greenhouse gas. It's used to cool copper tubing in data centers and must be disposed of when it's no longer effective.
F-gas can leak into the air where it transforms into another compound, trifluoroacetic acid, or TFA, which has been found to be toxic with detrimental effects on reproductive systems.
The increasing level of TFA in air, water, and humans worries scientists. F-gas can stay in the atmosphere for thousands of years.
In addition to using PFAS in cooling, data centers also use equipment like cables, pipes, and electronics that contain the compounds, which can move into the air or end up in landfills. And finally, the blob is back. And it's as big and bad as ever.
The blob is a large marine heat wave in the Pacific Ocean, and the current one stretches about 5,000 miles from Japan to the U.S., according to NOAA's Blob Tracker.
Blobs have occurred in each of the last 6 years, with five of them being the largest marine heat waves on record since monitoring began in 1982.
The warm ocean temperatures can stress marine life, causing fish die-offs and coral bleaching.
And its influence could mean more moisture is available for strong storms along the west coast. For the rest of the country, the blob could alter the jet stream and cause a colder, wetter winter.
But there's a wrinkle in these forecasts. According to the Climate Prediction Center, La Nina has arrived and is expected to hang around from now until February.
The La Nina climate pattern is when ocean water near the equatorial Pacific is cooler than average. It's in contrast to El Nino, when the water becomes warmer. Each has a different influence on weather and the jet stream.
So what happens when La Nina coincides with the blob? No one knows. According to meteorologist Joel Gratz at Open Snow, we haven't had a comparable winter in which both La Nina conditions and a strong blob were present simultaneously.
Colorado State climatologist Russ Schumacher told H2O Radio that there's always a lot of uncertainty in seasonal...
You are tuned to KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio